Hey everyone, this is Chris Mannix, and welcome to my first vertical podcast with Chris Mannix. Very excited about this entire podcast series and extremely pumped about this particular podcast. We're going to take a deep dive into some of the coaching changes that have occurred over the last couple of weeks, first in Phoenix, and I want to hit the Wayback Machine, kind of way back, and talk about the Cleveland Cavaliers and their decision to fire David Blatt. We're also going to check in with Paul Pierce, take the podcast on the road to Inglewood High School, sit down with him in his old locker room, and talk about some of the things that have happened to him over the last nearly two decades of his professional career. We'll check in with the Chicago Bulls and Casey Johnson, the great beat writer for the Chicago Tribune. He's going to join the podcast. The Bulls having a very good season, but if this team doesn't believe it can compete with the Cavaliers, could we see Chicago break its core up before the trade deadline?
Yahoo Sports presents the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your host, Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back. Vertical Podcast, Chris Mannix. Lot to get to over the course of this podcast. We'll have Paul Pierce. We'll have Casey Johnson. But I got to start with some of the news of the day, and I want to harken back a little bit to some of the news of last week. And the news of the day of this week, it's Jeff Hornacek, fired in Phoenix as head coach, a move that is not at all surprising to anyone that's followed the league over the last month. 2-14 the Suns were in the month of January. This is after Hornacek, in one of the rarest moves I've seen in coaching, had two of his assistant coaches fired in late December. So the writing was on the wall back then. Ryan McDonough, the Phoenix Suns, they pulled the trigger on it this week. Hornacek is gone. The Suns are looking for a new coach. I don't have much of an issue with this firing. I think when you underperform in the way the Phoenix Suns have underperformed, not just this year, where they only have 14 wins, but last year, when they went from a 48-win team to a 39-win team, you put your head on the chopping block. And I've watched a couple of Suns games live this season, most recently a game they played in Boston. And I didn't see much in the way of a team that was responding to its coach. And I'm not just referring to the Markieff Morris incident. I'm just saying out there on the floor, a team that plays with passion, with structure, with desire, it just didn't look like things were working for Jeff Hornacek. Now, all that being said, I wouldn't put it all on Jeff Hornacek. I look at this Phoenix situation as being an organizational problem. Now, look, they lost something when Eric Bledsoe went down for the season with that knee injury, but there has been a talent drain on that Suns roster. It's dated back over the last year plus. You go back to when Goran Dragic was traded last year, the trade of Marcus Morris in this offseason. These were crucial role players. And frankly, you can throw in the loss, and I use air quotes for that, of Markieff Morris. Because once you traded Marcus, because those two are like inextricably linked, you all of a sudden lose both players in that transaction. Because Markieff Morris, one way or the other, is going to get traded by Phoenix before this upcoming trade deadline. So I think Hornacek had his problems and did not distinguish himself in this final year as a head coach. But you got to look at the front office and look at ownership and say they made some decisions that took some players away from that roster. And that really hurt the Suns franchise. Where do they go from here? I wrote up on Yahoo Sports on the Vertical earlier this week. I said, one guy they're probably going to talk to, they're probably going to look at, is Steve Nash, the former Suns great, two-time MVP. You all know the story. Now, will Steve Nash want to go to Phoenix? I think if he was going to pick an NBA team to go to, it probably would be the Suns. The Suns are the franchise he had the most success with as a player. He is beloved in that community. This is John Elway going back to run the Denver Broncos. This is a player who could step in and be given an enormous grace period to help rebuild that team, either through coaching or through some type of front office management role. But Nash, from everything I hear and everything I certainly read over the last 24 to 48 hours, coaching, that may not be his thing right now. A full-time commitment to one organization, that may not be his thing right now. Steve, he's got his hand in a lot of different things at the moment. He's into soccer. He's into the Canadian men's basketball team where he's the GM. He's a part-time assistant coach, player development coach with the Golden State Warriors. He parachutes in there a couple of times a month. He may not want to get back into the day-to-day grind of the NBA just a year after he officially retired. So as much as Robert Sarver, the owner, may want Steve Nash, and I believe he really wants him, I believe these conversations have come up with Steve Nash over the last few months. Will you take a role with the team? What do you want to do here? Because Robert Sarver knows bringing Steve Nash in whatever capacity, that's something that is a positive for the Suns, because that franchise, that community, it's in a rut at the moment. It's got some decent young talent. It's got some solid, proven players in Bledsoe, Brandon Knight, and Tyson Chandler. But they're light years away from really competing. And I think the franchise and the community needs a jolt of something. And Steve Nash could be the guy that gives them that jolt. I really believe at some point, maybe it's not now, maybe it's not 6 months from now, but some point, the next couple of years, you're going to see Steve Nash make his way back to Phoenix, be more heavily involved with the Suns organization in some type of capacity. I think that's going to happen, but it may not happen right away. The other thing I want to get into, the Cleveland Cavaliers. I know it's an old story. Just give me a break. I know it's an old story, but I've been off for a little while making the transition from Sports Illustrated over to Yahoo Sports. I haven't had my podcast. I haven't had my radio show. I want to talk a little bit about this because I think the Cavaliers, making a mistake might not be the right phrase, but I think they made a bad decision in letting go of David Blatt. I really do. David Blatt is not Red Auerbach. He's not Greg Popovich. He's not Phil Jackson. Nobody would rank David Blatt amongst the top five or six, you know, X's and O's coaches in the NBA today. I'll grant you that. That being said, and I've talked to players on that roster about this specific subject, David Blatt wasn't a total disaster. And some of the smear pieces, some of the hit jobs, and I'm not blaming the reporters, they're just doing their job. It's the stuff that comes out of the organization, the smear, the negativity that surrounds David Blatt, I don't like. Because it seemed like as soon as they let him go, the organization, whether it's LeBron's people, management, whatever, it seemed like they were ready to go after David Blatt and tell the world just how mediocre a coach he was. Say what you want about David Blatt, but this guy got the Cavaliers to the NBA Finals last year effectively with one player. And I know it's one great player, and that's LeBron James, but they competed in the finals with really one proven player. They had the best record in the Eastern Conference when David Blatt was let go. I don't get it. I don't see the need to make this transition to Ty Lue right now, nor do I see the need to give Ty Lue this multi-year deal. I think Ty Lue is going to be a great head coach someday. He might be a great head coach this year. He's been a sought-after assistant coach over the last year plus. That's a reason the Cavaliers made him the highest paid assistant coach, or one of the highest paid assistant coaches, when they brought him in to be David Blatt's right-hand man. But just because it doesn't look like Blatt's connecting with LeBron James, and that has so much to do with it. There is no black and white here. It's not, it's LeBron's fault or not. I think LeBron and his team, they have some responsibility. They bear the burden of this. They had made it clear from everything I was told that they preferred somebody else other than David Blatt, that they preferred Tyronn Lue. Now, you should listen to your star players, but recognize this. LeBron was at his best when he really had no authority over what was going on with the coaching staff or with personnel. And I'm pointing to Miami and that situation down there for 4 years. Eric Spoelstra was the coach. There were some issues early on. Butted heads a little bit with Spoelstra. He bristled some at some of the things Spoelstra wanted him to do, but he adjusted to it because Spoelstra was the coach and Pat Riley was his boss, and Pat Riley wasn't letting Eric Spoelstra go anywhere. That's what made LeBron thrive. Now he's in this position. And look, if you're LeBron James, you love this position because you have so much power. You have so much power in that organization because you keep signing these one-year contracts that give you at least the sliver of an opportunity to go somewhere else. That gives you an enormous amount of influence in that organization. I don't think LeBron's running the day-to-day of the operation, but I also kind of snickered at the idea that LeBron wasn't consulted on this move. Maybe he wasn't consulted that day. Maybe David Griffin didn't ask LeBron James, do you want to see David Blatt fired today? But you don't ask questions to something you know the answer to. And I think the front office in Cleveland already knew how LeBron James felt about this coaching situation. Maybe it turns out I'm wrong. Maybe Ty Lue, smart guy, wants to play up-tempo. Maybe he's the right man for the job. Maybe this team recovers, goes on the kind of streak they did the end of last regular season, storm through the Eastern Conference playoffs, and wins a championship for Cleveland. If they do that, smarter man than I. But I just don't think this was the time, and I don't think it was the right move to let go of David Blatt. He had accomplished a lot. He had been proven. And letting him go, I think, sends a bad message to whoever holds that coaching job now. If you don't kind of fall in line with how other people want to do things, you may not last long on that job. All right, I just had to get that off my chest. Moving on. I spent some time out in California last week talking to Paul Pierce, the former captain of the Celtics, former Washington Wizard, former Brooklyn Net, now the LA Clippers forward, trying to win one more championship before his career is over. Now, the audio for this will not sound just like it sounds right here where I'm talking to you. I was in a gym. I was in a locker room at his old high school, Inglewood High School. Spent about 20 minutes, 25 minutes with him there. So it sounds a little different. But talking to Paul Pierce, getting to know the backstory of some of the stuff that went on in Boston, believe me, it's worth it.
You're listening to The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
Well, welcome back to The Vertical Podcast. That is on the road this week. We're in Southern California, because that's how important this podcast guest is. The guy I've been chasing around for months to do a podcast, Mr. Paul Pierce, the 10-time All-Star, former NBA champion, and my old boss, right? you were technically my boss, right?
He used to look out for me. He used to look out for me, though.
Did you consider yourself the boss of the Ball Boys back in the day?
I did. You know, I used to look out for them, and I make sure they was good. You know, they had to rebound for me, you know, make sure I was ready for the game.
Did you ever ask a ball boy to do something and then be like, man, I really should have done that myself?
Not really. You know, I really have respect for the ball boys. You know, a lot of them take time out of their schedule, out of school, you know, after school coming in, helping us get ready for the game. And I know I used to probably ask them to get there a little earlier, because I used to get to the gym like 3:30. And a lot of them be just getting out of school, and they'd come right after school and help me out. So, you know, I always respected the ball boys.
See, I got what I needed out of you, though, because whenever you were only about a year or two apart in age. Whenever you went out after Boston games early in your career, 23, 24 years old, I'd go wherever you were going. You were out, Kenny Anderson was out, I was right. Going wherever you were going, and I was like, I'm with him. I'm on the back end of him. You probably didn't see me 3/4 of the time, right. But I was always back end with you.
Right, hey, that's the perks, some of the perks that come with it.
We're here for some context for just for the listeners. Inglewood High School, your former high school, in what looks like a shrine to Paul Pierce of a locker room. You were telling me before we started, you helped redesign this room. What did you do here?
Yeah, well, this was a room that basically wasn't used. It was like a mini weight room, didn't have a lot of weights, but the ceilings was falling out, the walls was cracking. So I wanted to do something for the players, because when I was here, the locker room was terrible. We hardly used it. So I was like, you know, let's build a players lounge that the players could come in here and relax before the game, maybe watch some film, go over some tape, and just chill out and get their mind right for the game. So we came up with the idea to use this room, build it out for the players, and it's been successful. You know, they love it.
Good memories of this old school?
Great memories. You know, this is where it all started for me. This is where I took the next step at becoming a Division I ball player, and from there going to the NBA, but this is where it all started.
You were cut first couple of years, right? Your high school team?
I don't like to call it demoted. You know, I was, you know, up and down from the JV to the VAR. And then, you know, I mean, sometimes you get lucky and sometimes you're good and lucky. But I got the opportunity when some guys didn't show up to a Christmas tournament during the break, and I got an opportunity to play, and I was able to stick.
When you're demoted, let's use that word, when you're demoted there, does it affect your confidence at all at that age? Do you ever at any point in time think to yourself, well, maybe basketball isn't going to be what I maybe hoped it was?
I think for me, you know, when I was demoted, it pushed me harder, you know, because it's like you say you're not good enough. And I think as a player in anything you do, when it doesn't work out for you, it can go one or two ways. You can lose your confidence in it, or you can work harder at it. And then for me, it was like, you know, I think I deserve better. You know, I'm going to work harder at it to get better. And it really motivated me.
When did it go for you, the guy getting demoted to the guy being chased by Division I colleges?
I guess the biggest leap was between my sophomore year and my junior year. That summer, you know, I grew about 3 inches. I started to get some athleticism.
That was your thing?
I was like, you know, I was really self-motivated. So in the summer times, I always found myself in the gym. I always found myself on the track. I always found myself on the sand running, getting in shape. And it was just something like, I was motivated, man. When I look back, and it's like, it's crazy how you can say, how a young kid was just so motivated. But, you know, I had a dream, you know, and then my dream was to be an NBA player. You know, Magic, Bird, you know, those are my inspiration. Growing up here in Inglewood, watching the battles between Celtics and Lakers, and that's all the motivation I needed, and it just drove me.
Where guys grew up and where they went to school are often very different types of places, and you're kind of an example of that. Inglewood, California, and Lawrence, Kansas. I mean, when you visited Lawrence, Kansas, did you see anything there that you could connect to?
When I went to Lawrence, Kansas, it was during a time where it was Thanksgiving break. It was one of the first games of the season, and I don't think no students was on campus. And I went to the game, and so I visited USC, UCLA, Oregon, you know, different schools. But it's just like, it's like when you buy a new home, you go into different homes, and you're like, okay, you don't know, but you like, when you walk in there, you're like, this is it. It was like that when I walked into that gym. It was like, I didn't know if I wanted to go there, but when I walked in and I watched the game and I sat in the stands, it was just something that came over me that said, this is where I want to play, this is where I want to be. And it was just something I felt, because I didn't know prior to going there.
How much pressure did you get to stay close to home? Mention USC, UCLA. I would imagine a lot of people in your life are saying, don't go all the way to Kansas.
You know, it wasn't even really about the other people that put the pressure on me on not going to Kansas. It was more pressure on me leaving my mom. You know, my mom was a single parent mother. My two older brothers were out the house, so pretty much it was me and her in the house. So, you know, that was the hardest part, just leaving her, knowing she was going to be here by herself. You know, I was like, you know, the man of the house, and, you know, to leave her. So that was the biggest obstacle outside of people saying, don't leave, you know. But my mom was like, you know, you're going to be a man, make a decision, what feels best for you. And that was the decision I made, and I thank her for it.
Was Lawrence what you expected those 3 years?
It was more than I expected. I mean, I really didn't understand the culture, the Kansas history, you know, what it was all about. I just went there and I was just amazed by the crowd. You know, they don't have these type of crowds on the West Coast. You know, they're in there chanting, they're in there spending the night before the game. I didn't know, you know, it was way more than I expected. And I'm glad I made that decision. I mean, just to be able to be a part of this type of culture, that part of history, you couldn't ask for anything more as a college player, because a lot of schools don't have that.
What's something you took from Kansas that you now either use, something you eat maybe, something about the Kansas life that is still with you today?
Probably the pregame meals. You know, coach used to have pregame meals and routine for us. And that's something I took to the pro. We'll eat like around 3 and then like go to the game. And that's sort of like what I do now. It's like I take a nap, eat around 3 o'clock, and then I go to the game. So it helped you with routine. And so when I got to the pro, it's kind of like the same thing. And then it's like the same type of meal. You know, you have a chicken breast, rice, or some fish and a potato. And it was like the same type of meal. And that's something that I took from Kansas.
You declare for the draft in 98, and many projections have you going as high as number 2. You slip all the way down to number 10. When people talk about the last guy in the green room, you're an example of it. The camera's always on your face. Where is Paul Pierce going to go? Analysts talking about it. What was that night like for you?
Man, that was the longest 45 minutes sitting there when it started calling names in my life. I thought, you know, first 5 minutes, I'm going to get up, go shake the commissioner's hand. But then it got to number 2, 3 minutes on the clock. Number 3, another 3 minutes on the clock. And I'm like, once it got out the top 5, I'm like, you know, where am I going? Because I didn't work out for no other teams outside the top 5. So then we got to like 7 or 8. It was like Philadelphia, Larry Brown. All right, Kansas connection. I think that's where I'm going. You know, he had a chance to see me. He's going to pick me up. They need a 3-man. I'm going there. So then names call. I'm not there. So now I'm like, I don't know where I'm going. 9, Dallas. I don't know where I'm going. 10, Boston Celtics. They call my name. I'm like, Boston Celtics? All I'm thinking about now is, you know, my good friend Chauncey Billups was in college. You know, we played in the Big 12. We was good friends in high school. I talked to him his rookie year. And so I'm asking, you know, how's training camp? You know, how's it going? He's like, man, you know, we got like 5 players on IV. Training camp is so hard. Everybody be IVs. And I'm like, what? So when I get called to Boston Celtics, Rick Pitino's the coach, that's all I'm thinking about. Oh, man, this is going to be the hardest training camp of my life. I'm going to be on the IV. That's all I'm thinking about. I'm scared. And I'm like, the Boston Celtics? I hated the Boston Celtics growing up. And so I was like, how ironic is that?
That's what I was going to ask you next. Like, there's no black and whites, but it sounds like you're, if you're thinking, I'm going to play for Rick Pitino, is it, all right, I'm going to play for Rick Pitino. Okay, I got to play for Rick Pitino.
Oh, man. I'm like, I'm happy I'm in the NBA, but I'm like, of all places, Boston Celtics, of all coaches, Rick Pitino, who I've heard has had his run-ins with players and almost working them to complete exhaustion. I'm like, wow. Yeah, well, I guess, you know, this is where I'm supposed to be. You know, this is the challenge.
It's a broad question, but why didn't it work for Rick in Boston?
I think Coach Pitino, you know, he wanted to win right away. You know, I think it was hard for him being on a young team and going through the growing pains and dealing with the media pressure. You know, it's a lot of media pressure in Boston when you don't win. And I think, you know, when he took over and was the president and the coach, you know, people wanted results fast. And, you know, being a young team, it's hard to get results fast. You know, we're a young team building. And I just think that got to him. You know, he's been a coach that's been used to so much success in college, always won, to be able to go through a rebuild, knowing it'll take years. I think that's just something between that and the media just got to him.
There were a lot of ex-Kentucky guys on those early teams. Was that a good thing? Because people thought maybe that was a good thing for Rick. He's got his old guys back together, Antoine, Walter, Tony Delk, Ron Mercer, go down the list. Do you think that was a good thing looking back, or maybe not so much?
I mean, you know, he was familiar with them. You know, he knew what they brought to the table, but these weren't any Kentucky guys either. You know, these were top-notch players. I mean, these were all lottery picks. You know, these guys deserved to be where they were. And so I don't think it was bad for him to have his own players. It was just that, you know, like I said, we were young and, you know, we was going to go through our growing pains. And, you know, Coach Pitino wants results right away.
And was that the difference with when Jim O'Brien took over? Because you guys kind of took off. That January, Rick suddenly quits, and all of a sudden you guys are playing your way into the playoff mix. The following year, you play extremely well also.
You know, Coach O'Brien, I guess, brought new energy, I guess. You know, we were heading in the right direction, but, you know, Coach wanted to be at the top. He was no middle ground for him. Rick Pitino is all or nothing, it seems like. And then, you know, I think Coach O'Brien had a little more patience with us, really gave us good motivation, really inspired us, and we did take off. You know, we started playing well, really gave us the confidence, and we was able to make the playoffs, you know, under him.
You were part of two sort of generations of Celtic teams, the U and Antoine Walker Celtic teams, then the U, KG, Ray, Paul, refers for Rondo. The U and Antoine Walker group, would you say that group underachieved, overachieved, or achieved what they were supposed to?
I think that group pretty much maxed out what it was supposed to. But, you know, people forget under that era with me and Antoine, we were two games away from being in the finals. I mean, you know, I just thought if we could have just kept building on what we had, maybe another year or two, we'd be in the finals, especially the way the Eastern Conference was. And so we get to the Eastern Conference Finals, and then it's like we regressed with the players. You know, we didn't come back with the same players. We took players away. We traded away players. We didn't get better. And it just sent us back in the wrong direction when I thought, you know, we were building. And so, you know, I think pretty much that team was pretty much maxed out.
Game 3, Conference Finals against the Nets, the greatest comeback in NBA playoff history. Where does that game rank on your list of great moments? And
I mean, that's right up there near the top outside of winning the championship. I mean, that's like my first playoff experience, for one. And then to make history, you know, your first time ever being in the playoffs, it was like a great, great moment for me at that point in my career, being such a young player.
How did you do it? I mean, the Nets were good. Jason Kidd, Kenyon Martin, prime of their careers. You're down 20-plus. Do you remember anything about how you guys were able to pull that one off?
I just think it was the will. You know, when you got a combination of guys who have that will just to never give in and don't give up, no matter what the score, then, you know, anything can happen in a ball game with so much time. But if you have that defeatist attitude, like, oh, you know, this game is over, and you constantly say that to yourself, then you have a defeatist attitude. And I've never had that attitude. I always say, you know, the game is never over until I see a zero on the clock. And I've never been one to quit in the middle of a game, no matter what the score.
What happened in game 4, though? You guys, you had them beat. You took the life out of them, and they come back on your floor winning game 4. That was brutal. That was hard to see there.
You know, they had will. We had will. I mean, you talk about two teams playing to go to the championship. You know, neither one of them wanted to give ground. I mean, they had a little more experience players on their team, but you know, that was definitely heartbreaking. You know, I thought after we won game 2, we were going to the finals because people don't remember that year. We beat the Lakers twice, which seemed like a Laker team that was pretty much invincible with Shaq and Kobe. And we felt like if we got to the finals, we would have beat them.
How would you describe throughout those years your relationship with Antoine?
We had a great relationship on and off the court, man. We always hung out, went to dinners, went to the parties. I mean, you know, being young guys, you know, we had a good time. We always talked. He was like my best friend on the court. I mean, I go to Chicago, work out with him in the summers. We try to figure out how we're going to get better, how to make the team better. I mean, we had a great relationship.
When he was traded, the team starts to kind of go through change. That was when, I mean, towards the end, you wanted to finish your career in Boston. But there was that time, you know, 05, 06, that sort of period where you were looking, maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, but to go somewhere else in that time. What was your mindset like in those kind of rebuilding years?
Well, a lot of things happened during those years. You know, we had new ownership. We had new management. You know, Danny Ainge took over as the GM. We had new owners in Wick Grospek. So in my eyes, I just felt like they wanted to go in a whole new direction, you know, build a whole new team and pretty much start from scratch. Where I was, you know, I thought I was starting to enter the prime of my career. I was being an all-star. I'm getting better. And I'm like, you know, being so close, being in the Eastern Conference Finals, and it was just like all taken away. And I just felt like, you know, right now I'm playing some of my best basketball, and it's like it's going to waste because I'm not in the playoffs anymore. Nobody knows. I'm putting up, you know, stats, but they don't mean anything if you're not playing meaningful games in the playoffs. And it was just like, it was discouraging. It was just like, you know, I want people to know, you know, who Paul Pierce is, what type of player he is. But the only way to do that is to be on the big stage, be in the playoffs, and have a shot at the championship. And so it was discouraging playing so well and not, you know, reaping the team success that I wanted to reach. Because at the end of the day, that's how you're going to be measuring how your team does more than what you do as an individual. And when I didn't see that, the results of that, it was like it created doubt where maybe I can go somewhere else and find that.
How close were you to that happening, do you think? I mean, you were in those conversations, your agent was in those conversations. How close was it?
I think it was real close. It was like one summer, I think they had a trade on the table. Portland, because I think Danny wanted to get Chris Paul. And at the time, Portland was a mess. It was just like they weren't going to playoffs. They had a young team, too. Team players were always getting in trouble, and I was just like, you know, I'm not going to Portland. I think I made the announcement. I think I did an article in the paper saying I'm not going to Portland if I get traded there. You know, that's like, you know, I might as well stay in Boston if I go to Portland. So, I mean, I know that was the one trade I knew about that was on the table, and so that they were really close to pulling.
Were you pushing to go to a particular place back then, or was it anywhere?
I think back then I was telling my agent, you know, if you can get me to Dallas, you know, that's where I wanted to go at the time, because I was like, you know, I think Dallas is, you know, a player like me away from winning it. They were 50-game winners. Dirk, he was pretty much by himself. And I was like, you know, I even ran into Dirk and the Mark Cuban that summer and was like, you know, Mark, you got to try to find a way to get me over there. I want to be over here. I think I can help y'all get over the hump.
Did they try, to your knowledge?
I'm not sure how much they tried, but I definitely said something.
Things change, obviously, when KG and Ray are acquired. Rondo's obviously there. I mean, what was that like for you when it happened? Did you have to convince KG to come there? Because he's notoriously fickle about making moves.
You know, I think it was more from the story I heard. You know, KG's stubborn. He didn't want to get traded. He never wanted to leave Minnesota. I talked to him on the court like, man, you're going to come to Boston or I'm going to come to Minnesota. We've had those conversations on the court. But I think the biggest wild card player in that happening was, I think, Sam Cassell and Chauncey Billups, which is a good friend of KG's, because, you know, he was watching KG like everybody else put up numbers, be an MVP, and not getting the playoff success. And I guess also what helped him was us trading for Ray first. So once he saw Ray and me over there, I think the decision was easy for him to accept the trade, because he knew he was going to finally have an opportunity to win a championship, because it was going to be tough out there in the West with San Antonio, the way they were going, Lakers and Kobe Bryant, Dallas. There were so many great teams, and Minnesota was kind of stuck in the middle.
Did you have a relationship with KG before then? Because he's notoriously great with teammates, maybe not so much with guys on the other side.
I mean, you know, we talked a lot on the court. You know, we were good buddies in high school, and we always asked about each other's families and all the time, but We became closer than we were at the time once we became teammates because we knew each other from high school. He actually stayed at my house and played, you know, a couple tournaments with me in AAU.
That team is like, it spoiled things for every team that's put together with stars because everyone expects a star-driven team, whether it's the Lakers with Dwight Howard and Steve Nash and those guys, or even the Heat when they put LeBron and Wade together, to be like you guys. You guys start off like 22-3 or some insane number like that. I mean, what was it about that group of players that made you start out so strong and obviously sustain it all the way to a title?
I think it was just what I like to call it, the perfect storm. It was just like, you know, usually when you get a group of new players together, it takes a while to develop chemistry. But I think the way our games was, everybody complemented each other very well. I mean, the pieces just fit like a puzzle. And it was just like, you know, this is it. This is perfect. And then we saw it like the first day in training camp. We was like, you know, we said, okay, it's going to take a while. Then we started playing. We was like, it seemed like we've been playing together forever from the first day of training camp. But people don't know, we got there in September and we were playing pickup. And so, you know, all the guys are there. And so we're going to pick the teams. They was like, all right, Paul, pick the teams. And I was just like, all right, we're going to start off. Usually in pickup games, you're going to even out the teams. And I was like, all right, we're going to do this. We're going to go me, KG, Ray. Everybody was looking at me like, hold on, we're supposed to even out the teams. I was saying, man, listen, this is going to be the lineup. We're trying to get this thing right.
Who's on the other side? Like James Posey?
You know, you had all the rookies. You know, you had Tony Allen, you had Leon Poe, you had Kendrick Perkins, and I was just like, you know, me, Kevin, Ray, okay, Rondo, and then, you know, we're going to play against y'all, baby, Perk. You know, they was like, oh, that's not fair.
How nutty was Tony Allen back then?
Oh, man, I love the dude. He was like one of my favorite players, but sometimes you need a nutty guy like that on a team to win a championship. You know, he's a guy that's going to do all the dirty work. You know, you're not going to back down. And I knew that he was going to flourish as a defender once he left Boston because every day he had to guard me and Ray Allen. So, I mean, if you can do that every day in practice, you know, once you get into a situation where you start and you got to guard the stars, I was like, he's going to be somebody's worst nightmare because he's going to feel like it's easy to stop guys after guarding us.
How did your relationship with Doc evolve over the years? Because, you know, there were some times it wasn't great when you guys were struggling there, obviously win a championship, and now here you are playing for him again. You know, he's a big reason why you're out here with the Clippers. How would you describe how it's evolved?
I think, you know, winning, it cures all type of negativity. You know, when things are bad, every little thing is criticized, but you know, when you have an opportunity to win a championship, you know, that's special. That's something that sticks with you. That's a bond that you form with your coach and your teammates that lasts forever. And, you know, when we got the team and we started winning and doing better, you grow closer. I mean, I can't explain it, but that's just the way it is.
Did you not want to play for him in those struggle years? Was it?
I thought, you know, it was going to be difficult. You know, like I said, it was a time where I did want to go somewhere else because it was a struggle. And maybe this relationship wasn't going to work. You do think that.
When you win the title, you must have thought like, all right, we're all kind of in our prime here. Rondo's not even in his prime yet. We're going to run off a few. I mean, was that the mindset for you going into 08, 09?
Man, before when we sat and we got on the duck boat, I just remember the one question. You know, it was me, Ray, and Kevin. We got on the duck boat with Doc, rode around the town. And he was like, guys, this is the year now. We got to do it now. You know, everybody talking about we're going to take a year for us to get ready to develop our chemistry. We got to do it this year. And then I just remember KG was like, man, Doc, how many do you think we can win? He was like, I think we can get about two or three. And I was just like, man, this is really happening. This is an opportunity. I did think we could win two or three championships, especially after we won the first one. I was like, okay, we got the blueprint. But then, you know, everybody always says you got to be good and lucky. And I think in those other years, you know, we got unlucky. We had a chance the next year. Kevin got hurt. That really spoiled our plans. But then the next year, we go to game 7 with the Lakers. It can go either way in the fourth quarter. So we had our opportunity. It was there for us.
Who was the guy in those years that you loved to play against? Because it seemed for me like it was always LeBron.
I think.
You talked, and you guys both talked, and
yeah, I guess so. You know, you guys play the same position. You got this new young stud who's out there dominating the league. And it was like, this is my matchup. This is the guy. And I was like, you know, it had to be LeBron, you know, in those days. You know, before that, it was probably Vince because we were the same draft, and Tracy McGrady because we all played the same position.
Mm-hmm. How tough was that? I think it was 2010 or 11 when you had Miami there. You beat them on their home floor. You made the shot. And I think you walk back to the huddle saying, I got your 3, 4, 5 championships right here. If we could read lips in that moment, you were. It seemed like you had that one.
Yeah, we had them on the ropes. I mean, they were the favorite. They had home court advantage. Then we upset them in game 5. And I'm like, we going home to close this out, to go back to the finals. What better place you want to close out game than Boston? Then LeBron comes back and has this historic game. It was like, you know, that's what makes him great. You know, great players show up when it matters. And he has a pretty historic game where I don't think, you know, the greatest defender alive could have stopped him that day the way he was playing. And, you know, that's what makes him a great player, because they understand the moment. And, you know, this was would have been a blow on his resume if we had to beat them, you know, that year, because, you know, everybody already pegged them in the finals.
Is that the game that haunts you, or is there another game that
The one game that haunts me the most is game 7, 2010. I mean, we had lead.
13 points in the fourth quarter.
We were up double digits, and we got one of the stingiest defenses in the league. That game I still haven't watched. And then the only time I've seen it, it was through changing channels through Classic Sports, NBA TV, and I changed it right away.
Do you stop? Yeah, you right by it, right? You see
right
that one? We go right by it. The decline of those teams, injuries you can trace it to, obviously, with KG in 08 and 09. But the Ray Rondo rift, is there anything you wish you could have done more in that situation, or was it just beyond your control there?
I mean, I think it was more overblown than what people had said, because I think every team has their players that have rifts. I mean, that wasn't the only rift on our team. I mean, you got to understand, when you're around 15 guys, you're constantly on the bus, you're constantly on the plane, you're in the hotel, and it's around each other so much, sometimes you get tired of the guy. You know, one guy, my feet might stink, you get tired of him. One guy, you don't like the way he dressed. I mean, it's always something because you're around each other so much. Just like any kind of relationship, even with a woman, it's like you're around her so much, you might not like some of the things they do. So it's going to be that on, I think, every team. So I think it was overblown. But if you look on the court, they had great chemistry. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like you wouldn't have never thought it if you watched the court, because it seemed like every play was for Ray.
What's another riff from that team that we don't know about?
Man, you could say Ray Rondo, you could say Rondo me, you could say Rondo KG.
KG was like his big brother, though, out there sometimes. Oh,
they probably argued the most.
Really?
Yeah.
Feels like KG had such an Perk, especially. Like, I remember one player came up to me one year and said, what got into Kendrick Perkins his first year with KG? He's like, first year as a rookie, he's just this normal guy playing physical. Second year, he's like, MF this and I'm this and that. I mean, it seems like there was a lot of influence on KG on Perk.
That's probably the KG University is what we used to like to call it. You know, he went through KG University and graduated.
The end for that group, even before Rondo tore up his knee, that really kind of signified the end there. Did you guys feel like it was over? Did you feel like you still had something left to give with that team?
I feel like if we had just, you know, added a couple more pieces, we still had, you know, something to give. I mean, even though that year Rondo, we knew probably would be tough to win that year, but, you know, with him blossoming into an elite player, it was like, you know, with the contributions me and Kevin can give, you know, if Ray stuck around, we felt like, you know, it's still a team that could be dangerous. I mean, you look at San Antonio, what they're doing today. I mean, you got an older Duncan, Ginobili, older Parker, but they've been able to add the pieces around them to where they're still elite. And I felt like that's something we could have done.
Hindsight 2020, but given what you've experienced the last 2 years, first in Brooklyn, then in Washington, if you could go back in time to that end of that Celtic run there, what might you have done?
You know, I think, you know, history always plays its course. You know, I'm never, you know, I don't have any kind of regrets. You know, I loved all my time with the Boston Celtics, you know, from the start to the end. You know, I cherish all those moments, all those memories. I wish I could have ended my career in Boston, but the way the business is, you got to understand it. But at the end of the day, I'm thankful for all the many years, the great years I had there.
Would you still have wanted to go to Brooklyn?
Well, see, like, a lot of people say, you know, I want to go to Brooklyn and I want to get traded, but a lot of people don't know that. And he's talked about trading us the year before. You know, this is the stuff that was behind the scenes. I mean, he had a meeting with me, Kevin, and Ray. He's like, you know, is there a chance I'll trade y'all? You know, I'm just, you know, I'm the manager. I look out for the future of the franchise. That was the year before. So we knew the writing was on the wall that eventually he might trade us. So it was just like, you know, if I'm going to get traded, you know, all right, let's come to agreement right here. You know, it wasn't that I wanted to get traded. Everybody know I wanted to be a Celtic for life. But the year before, he even talked about trading us. So I knew that the writing was on the wall.
How much of a surprise was it to you that that didn't work in Brooklyn the way many anticipated it might?
It was a big surprise. I thought, you know, we had, you know, everything we needed. You know, we had veterans. We had every position covered. You know, I thought we could have been more threat than we were. I mean, we put up a good run the second half of the season. But, you know, I was a little disappointed, you know, on how it ended. You know, I would like to have another opportunity at a championship. I thought we actually was going to be better than Miami that year because we beat them all four times in the regular season. But, you know, it's hard to put together new pieces. You know, it's not going to work out all the time when you bring new guys in and think you're going to win the championship that first year.
What drives you now? You know, you've got your title. You're an icon in Boston forever. Now you go from Brooklyn, D.C., now to L.A. What motivates you now as you're in the last few years of your career?
Just my love for the game and my family. You know, my son, he's 2 years old. You know, I want him to have some kind of memory of me. So, you know, when I get up and go to the game and I go to practice, you know, there's times I bring them with me. You know, they're my motivation, you know, and another opportunity to win a championship. You know, that's all it is.
Do you feel with this Clipper team that they've got that kind of killer instinct that, you know, you tried to kind of impart that leadership on Deron Williams in Brooklyn? You've talked about it before. It didn't quite go the way you expected to go. Does this team feel different with the Clippers?
I think so. I think we have all the pieces to win. It's just about bringing it together now, you know, coming together at the right time. And I think we're starting to get it. You know, I think we still have some things to work on. And, you know, you learn those things throughout the course of a season, and we still have time, but we're starting to get it.
You got a 3-year contract with the Clippers. Is it a 3-year contract for you, or are you year to year?
I'm year to year at this stage. You know, I'm going to reevaluate at the end of this year, you know, see how my body feels, see the situation, if I'm comfortable with it, and go from there. You know, I've had a long, great career, and, you know, but if we win a championship, that may be it. You know, they may definitely seal the deal, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's year to year right now, and just seeing how I feel. It's going to be a family decision when I talk with my family and go from there.
What's post-career Paul Pierce do?
You know, I may be doing your job, man. You know, I may be sitting on that side of the table, you know, giving great interviews or, you know, maybe commentating. I always love those type of things. I don't know about coaching. I love the game. Maybe you want to have some type of influence with the game, whether it be general manager or analyst or something like that.
Do you ever interact with Red Auerbach in Boston?
Oh, man, all the time.
Yeah.
All the time, man.
What's one of those interactions like?
Man, just, you know, for him being an older guy, when I met him, you just don't realize how smart he still is. I was like, man, this guy can still coach the game if he wanted to. You know, he'll come in and talk about, you know, you need to do this. We're on defense. You're shooting the gap and on the pick and rolls. And then at the end, he'll give me a cigar. I had so many cigars in my locker. And I said, I'm going to put it right here until I win the championship. I had so many cigars in my locker every time he came around.
Do you still have a Red Auerbach cigar anywhere?
Probably somewhere. But I know I lit one up when we won it because I kept them.
Did you interact with Bird much when Bird was pre-Larry coach, when he was kind of hovering around there?
No, I really didn't have a lot of run-ins with him, actually. You know, only time I used to see him was in the stands in Indiana. Mm-hmm. You know, but a lot of the other greats like Bill Russell, Bob Cousy, obviously Tommy Hines, and then mm-hmm. Cornbread, and John Havlicek would come around a lot. Those guys I had a lot of interaction with.
Tommy Hines had loved you.
Oh, man, I love Tommy.
There's no more over-the-top announcer than Tommy Hines.
Oh, I love him. He's one of the best.
Any other favorite stories from Boston that you...
I don't know. Just so many memories, man. I'm just, you know, I guess I'll put it all in a book when I'm done. I just have so many great stories and so many memories from those 15 years. You know, I'm thinking about putting it all together in a book.
And I mean, you really grew up there. I mean, that was...
I pretty much became a man out there.
You had, I mean, not to get too deep into bad stuff, but when you, the night you were attacked in Boston, that was, I mean, the whole town kind of rallied around you in that moment.
It was crazy because Patino was talking about, do I want to get traded? And it was just like, no, you know, I think I want to be here. You know, I love the city. I love this team. I love the franchise, you know. You know, it just, the city embraced me and I embraced it, no matter what I've been through.
Did any part of you, after that happened, want to get out?
Not at all. I mean, Rick Pitino asked me if I wanted to, and I told him no.
What made you want to stay?
It was just that I just it was like a feel. I felt like I needed to be here regardless of the situation. It was just like, man, this is, if it's going to end for me, my life, it's going to be right here, you know, because I love the fans here. I love the franchise. I love the history. You know, I wanted to be here.
Did that change your life in any ways?
Oh, it definitely changed my life. I mean, when you go through life-threatening situations like that, it helps you grow up a lot faster. You become a lot mature. You learn to appreciate the people around you. You do things different. It definitely changes your life.
Paul Pierce, worth the travel to Southern California to do this, man. Thank you.
Man, good to see you.
Appreciate it.
No doubt.
It's the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
All right, guys, just a quick reminder. Along with this podcast, don't forget to subscribe and listen to the Vertical Podcast with Woj and the Vertical Podcast with JJ on Yahoo Sports, iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn. When it comes to the NBA, it's about as inside as you can get. Here at the Vertical Podcast, we like to leave room for growth. We want the show to, you know, get better as time goes on, which is why for the first podcast, I want to welcome in the most mediocre beat writer in I know, Casey Johnson from the Chicago Tribune, who you can follow on Twitter, if you must, at KCJ Hoop. What's up, man?
I'm so glad your contractual obligations to continue ripping me whatever your place of employment is has played out in spectacular fashion.
I don't think I could go anywhere unless I could take shots at my friends on the beats out there. I wouldn't know what to do with myself. If I was forced not to do that, I don't know what I would do.
It makes you the special person that you are.
Speaking of special, segue, the Bulls, not so special, at least not right now. But let me, big picture here, 26-20, no Noah the last few weeks. Do you think the Bulls, would they be satisfied with this if they were told this was where they'd be at the start of the season?
No, just because, I mean, it has been a weird season, and you're right, they're not very special right now. They just finished an 8-8 month in January, and It's obviously been difficult to fully judge them because they've been down, you know, a pretty critical starter in Dunleavy all season. And then you add the Noah loss on top of that. And then they had other rotation guys in and out of the lineup like Derrick Rose, Kirk Heinrich. So, you know, like a lot of teams are dealing with injuries, but it hasn't had a smooth feel to the season from the get-go. So even though they, you know, have endured a lot of injuries and are six games over, I would probably think that they're not satisfied with where they're at.
Where are we at this point in the soap opera that can be Fred Hoiberg? I mean, where is this team? Are they on the same page with Fred at this point? You're around them every day. What is the vibe with the roster and with Fred?
Yeah, I don't think this season has anything to do with a coaching issue. I mean, if you look at, you know, how Fred coached Iowa State, I think the problems go deeper in terms of the fit of the roster. I mean, I think you've got personnel that doesn't really fit exactly what Fred has wanted to do, and that's why he's openly talked about how they started going back to things that they ran in the past under Tom Thibodeau. You know, at Iowa State, he usually only played one big, and that big wasn't always even near the block. He was out. He liked to, you know, have his point guards play with a lot of pace and thrust. You like to spread the floor with shooting, and you know, you've had guys that are in bigger roles like Nikola Mirotic and Doug McDermott who were earmarked for those roles, and then they just haven't been consistent enough to take advantage of them. So you're going to look like a lot of teams this summer to make changes to the roster with the salary cap going up and big guys coming off their books like Gasol and Noah. But I think Fred's had a learning curve like any first-year NBA head coach. I'm not saying he's a perfect coach, but I don't look at their record of this season and say, oh, this is a Fred Hoiberg problem.
Do you think management anticipated these problems coming in? You know, you mentioned the one big and some of the issues they've had adjusting to Fred. Do you think there was an anticipation of all this, or is this closer to a surprise?
I think it's closer to a surprise. They obviously probably wouldn't say that publicly. They may say it privately, but, you know, as I mentioned before, and not just to single out two guys, but let's look at Nikola Mirotic and Doug McDermott. Everyone talked about how, you know, Doug McDermott had a redshirt season his rookie year. He had the knee issue, but, you know, wasn't in the rotation otherwise. Nikola Mirotic was to a certain degree, but, you know, not early. And so those two guys were pegged for much bigger roles under Fred Hoiberg. I mean, you benched a former first-team All-NBA center to start Nikola Mirotic and Joakim Noah, and they just have not produced consistently. And so if you're looking at what management envisioned, they envisioned Fred Hoiberg's offensive acumen and guys that they felt maybe had been underutilized previously, meshing to kind of form this more potent offensive team, and that just has not been the case. The Bulls have languished near the bottom of offensive rating all season, and they've had flashes where they've looked really good, but it certainly hasn't been on a consistent basis.
What's happened to Mirotić in particular? Because Doug McDermott, I wasn't all that convinced he was going to be a rotation player anyway, but Mirotić was a guy that towards the end of last season, I was looking at him as one of those sleeper candidates for Rookie of the Year because he was playing so well on a team that was actually doing something. That's when we were kind of all caught up in, like, why do we keep voting for players that are putting up numbers on bad teams? Mirotić was putting up decent numbers, but they were on a good team. What's changed with him this season?
Right, and then he had that, you know, he led the NBA in fourth quarter scoring,
yeah.
You know, second Rookie of the Year voting. So, to me, yeah, he's kind of the poster child for the inconsistency of the season, because as I keep mentioning, he's kind of the guy that Fred zeroed in on and said, this is going to be the philosophical, he's going to represent the philosophical shift. I mean, again, you take out Joakim Noah from the starting lineup and in favor of this guy. So what I've seen happen is someone who just is not really mass. Two things, Chris. He has not gotten much physically stronger since he's come into the league. He has openly talked about how he did not lift a lot when he played overseas as a professional in Europe, and you would think that would be priority for him here, and he says he's done it more, but his body just hasn't changed that much. So that's part of it. And then the bigger thing is he just hasn't mastered one thing. If you watch him play this season, and obviously he's out right now after an appendectomy, but if you watch him play, it seems like when he catches the ball, he almost goes through a mental checklist of all the different things he thinks he can do with the ball. He's got skill. There's no question of that, but he's thinking too much and he's going through the mental checklist. So he hasn't really, to me, mastered one thing. Is he a catch and shoot guy? Is he a drive guy? Is he a post up guy? You can't really point to any of those things and say he does them consistently. He does them at times and he looks really good doing all three of those things at times, but he hasn't focused on one thing and mastered it. So, and now it's clearly, to me, gotten to his head a little bit. Before he had the appendectomy, he actually started to play a little bit better. But I think his confidence, he's openly talked to me about it. You know, his confidence took a hit when he was struggling a little bit. So that's a big problem, because he's clearly earmarked as a core piece moving forward with this team.
I mean, the reason I bring up and have brought up Hoiberg is I was reading one of your recent pieces, and there were some pretty damning quotes in there. I mean, Pau Gasol's stood out in particular, where he said, "We're not disciplined. That's a fact." When you hear a guy say that, what goes through your mind that at this point in the season, a team this experienced is not disciplined?
Well, okay, but the thing I would say to that is, and you're also obviously, we shouldn't brush over the extremely high-profile incident in December when Jimmy Butler said we need to be coached harder.
Yep.
But see, the thing is, you're talking to someone who heard a lot of the, maybe not the discipline quote, because you never pin that on a Tom Thibodeau coach team, but you're talking to someone who heard a lot of these kind of, you know, we can't put our finger on what the issue is answers last season, because the same problem played out a lot of the times last season in terms of inconsistency and guys, you know, saying they didn't know why they showed up one night and then not the next. It was the first time in Tom's, very successful five-season run that happened, and they still won 50 games. But it was clear that last season guys are starting to use a Tom Thibodeau phrase, let go of the rope a little bit. And so, a quote like that jumps out at you. But, I mean, I've seen this movie last season where they have a very, very impressive victory and then followed up with kind of a befuddling performance. And I think it's just a sign of a team that's kind of done. This team, as it's currently constructed, I think this window is, you know, kind of coming to a close here. And obviously with Gasol and Noah coming off the books, and you're going to have an opportunity to retool a little bit.
Yeah, and I want to get to that, but I want to ask you first about Rose. And, you know, I was at that game with you in Boston where Rose put up 16 in the third quarter. And in that third quarter, I'm looking at him like, damn, that's old kind of Derrick Rose. And if you look at his numbers in the month of January, you know, they're up. I mean, the three-point shooting, I don't know if he's ever going to be a real three-point shooter, but, you know, the field goal percentage, the scoring, they've increased by the month. What have you seen from Derrick Rose this season? And do you hold out any hope that you're going to get anything close to the player that we once saw before all the injuries.
Well, I think you still have definitely moments of that. I mean, I actually thought yesterday in the matinee against the Clippers, he was incredible. He was 10 for 17 from the floor. Almost everything was at the rim. It was that kind of torque and hard cutting and, you know, burst and strength and speed going to the hole that you're kind of used to seeing from the old Derek. I don't think you're going to see Derrick Rose ever become an MVP of the league again, but he certainly has the athleticism and the speed and the strength and the skill to still perform at a very, very high level. And as far as what I've seen, I mean, it's almost simplistic to say, you know, use a symbolism of when he ditched the mask, which coincidentally was against the Clippers when they were in Chicago in December. But that left orbital fracture really messed him up mentally a little bit. It was the first summer he was not rehabilitating an injury since 2012. That's all we talked about going into training camp. Well, here comes a healthy Derrick Rose. And then, boom, within the first hour of the first training camp practice, Taj Gibson breaks his face. I mean, come on. So he really just kind of eased into the season after that. And when he ditched that mask in mid-December, now he's been in and out of the lineup with tweaks here and there with hamstring issues and a sore back and sprained ankle. But for the most part, since he ditched that mask in mid-December, you've seen Derek kind of become that attacking, you know, penetrating Derek that we're used to seeing. So I still think, you know, he can play at a very, very high level. And I know for a fact, you know, obviously opposing coaches still game plan for him a lot.
You mentioned the possibility of changes this offseason, most notably because there are guys that are going to be free agents, Joakim Poeltl, at the top of that list. But what about before that? I mean, we're less than 3 weeks away from the trade deadline. I kind of thought that if Joakim didn't get hurt, that he could have been someone shipped out of town in a deal. But how active do you expect Chicago to be over these next couple of weeks trying to retool this roster?
Yeah, the no injury really, really hurt that. I mean, I still think they'll be listening, and if something makes sense, obviously they'll do it. But there's two things to play here. The Noah injury has really affected their ability to maybe move one of their bigs, because Bobby Portis, as promising as he's going to be, as promising as he is, and I think he projects to be certainly a rotation player, you know, very quite possibly an NBA starter. He's kind of coming to earth a little bit here. He's on team scouting reports now, so offensively he's not making as much of an impact. Defensively, I think he's starting to struggle a little bit. He's out of position a lot. He's in foul trouble, maybe hitting that rookie wall a little bit. So, with Noah's injury, that really affects their big man depth. I still think they'll probably check to see what they can get for Gasol, since they almost certainly are going to lose him for nothing this summer. But, you know, the other thing is what they're looking at to do is upgrade the wing position. And you've got to look at it as Mike Dunleavy is your trade deadline acquisition. I mean, Dunleavy is, without, you know, barring a setback, is within a week or so away from returning from off-season back surgery here. So he's obviously a guy, you know, while maybe not flashy or dynamic as far as a score, is really that glue kind of intangible guy that I think can certainly solve some of their inconsistencies that have plagued this team throughout the season.
You know what's strange, and tell me if you're on the same wavelength with me about this. I look at the Eastern Conference standings, and Atlanta's kind of a more extreme example based on everything I'm hearing about what they're trying to do before the deadline. But you've got two teams in the top four, top five of the Eastern Conference bracket in Atlanta and Chicago with some of the moves they might be inclined to make that are kind of willing to sacrifice this season in the hopes of making their team better in the future. I mean, you see what I'm saying? Like, it's almost like they look at Cleveland and be like, well, screw it. We can't beat them. So why don't we look more long-term?
I completely agree. I can only speak for the Chicago example. I can speak for Atlanta, but I completely agree with you on that in terms of the Bulls. And that's where, look, that no injury really, really hurts them, because you can never predict with 100% certainty in the trade market, because something's got to make sense. You obviously need two, sometimes three teams to make a deal. But if Noah had not gone down, I would have been more surprised than not if they hadn't made a deal. But with Noah going down, I think it's probably a little bit less likely that they make a deal. But, yeah, I mean, again, you're never going to get a team official to come out and say, oh, yeah, we're waving the white flag on this season. But I do think the Bulls now are starting to look long-term, not only because – I'm not saying Cleveland's unbeatable, but they now also see that this transition's got to take place. You've got Fred Hoiberg signed for 5 years, and this first year has not gone the way you envisioned, so you've got to start getting people to fit his offensive vision and kind of retool this team. I think it's going to be tough because I keep coming back to, I mean, McDermott and Mirotić were not penciled in. They were indelible markered into those plans, and they have just not performed at a consistent level this season.
If teams call tomorrow about Derrick Rose, how seriously does Chicago listen?
That's a tough one. I mean, you always have to listen, but I've not gotten any sense internally that the Bulls are dissatisfied with Derrick Rose. I mean, I, you know, this has been a season where it's been clear from Derrick's perspective and approach that he's, if his body's not 100% right, he's going to take a game or two to make sure it is. And I may be in the minority here, but I personally think that's the right approach. Some people call that soft. I call that smart. He hasn't played much basketball the last three seasons. So, and it's not like he's missed a lot of time, but he's played at a really, really high level in January. And you know, moving forward, I can see that getting better. So I think they listen, but I don't think that they would be pulling the trigger on a trade like that.
Are they dissatisfied with the coverage from the Chicago Tribune?
Aren't they always?
They have to be, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, Casey, all kidding aside, you're the best, man. The voice of the Bulls out in Chicago, writing for the Chicago Tribune. Follow him on Twitter, at KCJHoop. Always welcome here on the Vertical Podcast, my friend. Thanks for coming on.
I appreciate it, Chris, and happy that you found a home commensurate with your talents.
I don't even know what that means, but I'll take it.
I don't either. I think we should end this. I'll talk to you later.
Thanks, man. That's it for this week's edition of the Vertical Podcast. My thanks to Paul Pierce, my thanks to Casey Johnson, and my thanks to you, the listener. Don't forget, you can check out a brand new podcast every Tuesday for, Matt, let's call it eternity, right here on the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice. Find your voice.